the first incitement. I have had the good fortune in the past several years, since shortly after the publication of my third book of poems, Catalogue of Unabashed Gratitude, and probably again with my book of essays, The Book of Delights, to have had numerous and sustained conversations about joy. These conversations might begin during question and answer sessions, in interviews, or even in the book signing line. I'll never forget a woman at a reading in a public library in April of 2016 in Claremont, California, one of those weird, beautifully ugly 60s California buildings. It was a rancher of a library, and maybe with some faux stone on the front, maybe white brick. I suspect she was in her late 60s or early 70s. And as she asked me to inscribe catalog, she was crying, just a little, not very able to talk. And she said, quietly, wiping her face, "I didn't know you could write about joy." Or another time, this one from an undergrad at a reading I was giving, who was about midway through a Q&A and said something along the lines of, "I have always been told that you can't write about joy because it's not serious." And a professor at another school asked, as much for the benefit of his students as it was a challenge, though that might be giving him the benefit of the doubt, which I'm practicing doing more of, "When all of this is going on," he held his hands up as though to imply war, famine, people all over the world in cages or concentration camps, some of them children, disease, sorrow immense and imperturbable, it only getting worse and worse and worse. Dude has big hands. "Why would you write about joy?" The implication, of course, is that joy does not have anything to do with everything in that guy's big hands. Or even that joy is the opposite of what's in there. Which I guess is a reasonable notion, given how joy is often imagined to be the result of organizing our closets and bookshelves, or getting the new Tesla, or winning the big game, or acing the test, or getting a promotion, or getting our dishes sparkling clean. Given that joy is often imagined as the result of some accomplishment or acquisition, something nice you get out there and do, something nice you go get yourself. Joy, the thinking goes, is that room at the top of a flight of stairs that, upon entering, washes you with clean air and glad music and comfy furniture and gentle warmth emanating from the white pine floors, suffused with light pouring in from the enormous windows with a sweet window seat where you can read a happy book. The joy room, the thinking goes, is snug with every good and nice and cozy thing. Oh, too, this is very important, this sanctuary of joy has a very strong lock. Think Tom and Jerry, 10 or 15 latches and deadbolts and chains and the rest. For when heartbreak, which it should be noted usually lives in the filthy back corner of the back room of the basement, where the stone walls are always wet and flickering with roaches and the drain with the furry green stuff crawling from it never all the way screws down, gets loose and comes sniffing around the keyhole, throttling the door, trying to get in. Perhaps in the form of your father dead, or your mother despondent, or your cousin who shot herself in the chest, or your buddy stabbed to death, or your dutiful and troubled mind, or the most beautiful ball player you ever coached at last let off the machine, or your child who won't forgive you, or you can't get your medicine, or your beloved doggie's cough won't stop, or the forest you love has been logged, or the school shut down, or they poisoned the water again, or they put a highway through again, or another species gone, or it's raining in Greenland, or. You get my point. It is a kid's fantasy, by which we grown-ups seem as seduced as plenty of kids, to imagine any emotion discrete from any other. But it strikes me as a particularly dangerous fantasy, by which I mean also it is sad, so goddamn sad, that because we often think of joy as meaning without pain, without sorrow, which, to reiterate, our consumer culture has us believing is a state of being that we could buy, not only is it sometimes considered unserious or frivolous to talk about joy, i.e., but there's so much pain in the world, but this definition also suggests that someone might be able to live without, or maybe a more accurate phrase is free of, heartbreak or sorrow. Which I'm pretty sure you only get to do if you have no relationships, love nothing, are a sociopath, or maybe if you're enlightened. I don't know about you, but I check none of these boxes. I just think Ross is so great. Hello, everyone. This is Unique Traveler Bryant, and we just jumped right in to Inciting Joy by Ross Gay, who's one of my goddamn favorite poets in the fucking world. I mean, come on. It is a kid's fantasy to imagine any emotion discrete from any other. That's just, like, whew. So much about, I think, what I do. And I shared a little bit in the post that I am such a fan of the Book of Delights, which is one of the works Ross Gay mentions that I have read. And from there already, you sort of see this coming, which is this really full-throated, full-hearted defense of the complexity and the solemnity and the weight of joy, of delight, of pleasure. And it's interesting. It's interesting that he describes this cozy room, because I think, you know, with full candor, cozy was an early draft idea of how to invite people to the Till Library. And it is one that I have at many times considered changing, considered getting rid of, have thought maybe cozy, oh, you know, I get self-conscious. It feels light. It feels frivolous. It feels silly. It feels like the kind of instruction that one does maybe a little sheepishly, right? It's hard to, with a straight face, tuck oneself in. But I think that that tension, I think that that embarrassment, I think that that, when you think about it, bizarre resistance to niceness, to having nice for ourselves, I think that's the point. I think that's the sort of quietly dangerous thing that one can do is to invite, to call, to incite an audience to niceness. And to hold space for that and fill that space with things that aren't soft and cuddly, with things that are sad, that are distressing, that are scary, that are disgusting, that are any number of things. To have no emotions be discrete from the others, to have a world where you can slide suddenly from one tone to another, and to say, to claim, that all of those things live inside the nice place. That in fact, it could be nice to do all those things, to permit ourselves all those things, and that it could be a form of niceness we give ourselves to access them, is a way that I think about the Tell Library, and is a thing that I find so much in Ross Gay's work. And in this work, more so than in previous things I've accessed by him, a really interesting thread that reminds me that nice is not harmless, and that gentle is not without teeth. Gentle is not strong, and gentle is even not angry. That's a really fascinating part, and this is the second part I'd like to read. Where I feel like some of the kind of lingering edge that exists throughout this book that is maybe not showing up quite in the same way, although I'm sure if I reread Book of Delights, I'd find it there, but that I really could feel palpably throughout this book really came out for me in this section, which I think is just remarkable. This is from the third incitement, which is gardening, which is a topic Roske is always really beautiful and eloquent on. It is now probably a useful time to address a question that might be lurking for you, which is something along the lines of, yeah, but isn't gardening a privilege? How could he be talking about gardens at a time like this? By which you mean the experiences I'm talking about, and which I'm saying are connected to joy, are not afforded to those who do not have access to a garden, green space, etc. Gardens and joy, the question understands, are privileges. Great point. And one thing I want to be cautious of, by which I mean really refuse, are the ways we sometimes consider, for instance, gardening, or health, or healthcare, or potable water, or clean air, or pleasant and stable housing, or decent jobs, or good schools, or libraries, or living relatives, or being unabused, or having free time, or not being imprisoned, or not living near a power plant, or an incinerator, or a landfill, or a million acres of corn or soybeans sprayed with toxins, a privilege. Which actually obscures the fact that to be without a garden, or to be without green space, or to be without access to a park, or clean water, or the forest, or fruit trees, or birdsong, or shade, or a deep and abiding relationship with a tree, or to be without health care, and so often to be without health, is violence. It is abnormal, even if it is the norm. And it is an imposition of precarity that is not natural. All these comorbidities, all these communities more exposed to toxins, all this absence of sick pay or good pay every day is not simply an affliction. Aw, too bad you landed in Cancer Alley. Or, oh, bummer about all those opioid deaths. Or, so unlucky about the lead in your water. But an infliction. It is on purpose. And the withholding from some of the means of life, of which means there are plenty to go around, is a disprivilege. Footnote on plenty to go around. In the event that this claim puzzles you, seems over the top, here's something to consider. This book was written not only during one of the largest upward transfers of wealth in the history of the world, but as Congress passed a $768 billion defense spending bill. Footnote on is a disprivilege. A slant analog is in the difference between the word slave, which implies a natural condition, and the word enslaved, which implicates the enslavers. And rather than indulging in virtue signaling that simply reifies or maybe even enjoys the guilt, guilt can be titillating, let's admit that, bathing in it oneself or dumping it on others of so-called privilege, rather than waiting around in that little, impotent, indulgent cesspool of hand-wringing regret, how about instead we figure out how to get rid of disprivilege? Which we could do. Part of which involves acknowledging that, baseline, we should all be able to get into a garden, or a forest, or an orchard if we want. It includes acknowledging that we should all have clean drinking water, and good schools, and excellent health care, and safe housing. What would happen if we acknowledge that none of this is privilege, but rather it is as it should and could be? And what if we figured out, together, in a million different ways, how to make it so? Or, to say it another way, rather than cursing the darkness, what if we planted some seeds? It's really interesting for me to hear Roske address the kind of response to the work of how can we talk about joy at a time like this? How can we pushing back against that resistance? Unsurprisingly, the last chapter, the 14th incitement, which is gratitude, really hits. And those of you who read through my post on Roske, and maybe even treated yourself to Roske's catalog of unabashed gratitude, could get a sense of what it is, and it is in that vein and more, and really like a product of this book, and I think the explorations in it. If you didn't listen to that, I beg you to. I think that video that I included is just one of my absolute favorite things. But he talks about the experience of having a white woman at a reading of his saying something like, "How can a black man write about flowers at a time like this?" And he has this quote of saying, "You need to grow up if you think it's not always a time like this. And you need to shut up if you think you know what this black man or anyone ought to be writing right now. Grow up and shut up." But I try to know better than to spend time on that question, which is no question at all. It's a shackle. It's a cell. You need to grow up if you think it's not always a time like this. Ooh, there's more in that comment than I could unpack, certainly in this space and maybe with any amount of time. And so instead, I will just incite you all to read this goddamn book. It is so good, and it is so, I think, important. And I think Ross is, at times, even cantankerous and impatient with many modern things. But I think that there's a vision of joy and a vision of the strength and robustness of softness that Ross has that really speaks to, informs, and inspires the work I try to do. And I will end this particular reading with a secret, which is that when Ruske talks in the beginning about people coming up to him in lines at book signings and being weepy, that 100% was me at the Free Library of Philadelphia not too long ago when I got this book. God, I was absolutely starstruck and remain such a huge fan of his work. And I hope that after this month of me just banging the drum over and over, if you weren't already, I hope you will give yourself the gift of becoming a fan of his work too. And that is all I have for you this month.